I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is Gabor Giori, senior analyst at the Policy Solutions Think Tank in Budapest, Hungary, discussing the Hungarian Jewish community today. We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, our two Jewish maven on Israel, Oshrat Barel, and our maven on Jewish education, John Ben Asher. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. There have been a series of bomb threats made against JCCs around the country over the past 2 months, including one just last week here in Tucson, Arizona, where I live. I wrote an email the morning after that to my congregation in response, and I thought I would share some of my thoughts with you about this latest wave of anti-Semitic intimidation. As I'm sure you know, the bomb threats at the JCCs have all proven to be false alarms. They are despicable acts, the actions of cowards and bigots. But for all the attention they've garnered, they are also empty threats. To date, there have been no bomb threats made against synagogues anywhere nationally, by the way. I do vividly recall a bomb threat I experienced 44 years ago during the Yom Kippur War when I was just 12 years old. We all evacuated while the police searched. And then we returned to continue prayer and study, those primary Jewish acts. These cowardly threats are designed to intimidate a people who has survived much worse. The best response to these small, pathetic criminals is to affirm our own Judaism more proudly and more actively. There are two primary human motivations, love and fear. Judaism believes firmly in the love of family, principle, and ethics. We believe in the love of God and our people. Those who choose to spread fear are making a foundational error. They are seeking to spread fear, but they are weak, sad, and pathetic, and they will fail. Love inevitably conquers fear, and so it will prove here. The best response to these threats is for Jews to affirm our identity more proudly and more actively in the face of this attempted intimidation. We refuse to be intimidated. We choose instead to continue to act for good, studying, praying, doing social action and advocacy, working for tikkun olam, the perfection of our world. It is perhaps ironic that these threats and the recent Jewish cemetery desecrations in Philadelphia and St. Louis come as we approach the holiday of Purim, for Purim remembers the first evil effort to annihilate the Jews in history, led by a vicious anti-Semite named Haman. It is placed in the days of the ancient Persian Empire nearly 2,500 years ago, and it shows the jealousy and hatred of a vicious man acted out as attempted genocide. We Jews were saved by the heroic efforts of a court official Mordechai and the Jewish Queen Esther, and our enemies were punished, but it was a close-run thing. We were fortunate to survive. In the end, this irrational hatred of Jews ultimately ended up benefiting us, at least in the Purim story. The Jews are saved, we celebrate, and today we enjoy a wonderful festival. Of course, many times in history the results have not been so happy. Anti-Semitic crimes have repeatedly massacred our people and destroyed crucial aspects of our sacred culture and great learning. The good news is that we do have Purim to celebrate our victory over the evil Haman, and we continue to work to assure that Jews triumph over this latest round of anti-Semitic provocation, because good will triumph. And love will conquer fear. In the spirit of Purim, to play us in, here's a traditional Purim song this morning, Utsu Etza, sung by cantor Paul Zim.
Utsu Etza vetufar, dapru dabar velo yakum. Utsu Etza vetufar, dapru dabar velo yakum, ki imanu kel. Utsu Etza vetufar, dapru dabar velo yakum, ki imanu kel. Utsu etza vetufar, dapru dabar velo yakum. Utsu etza vetufar, dapru dabar velo yakum, ki imanu kel. ça va tu far da puta barvello ya cuti di manu che uzzo e ça va tu far da puta barvello ya cuti di manu.
That was Utsuetsa by Paul Zim for Purim this coming Saturday night and Sunday morning. At my own Temple Emmanuel here in Tucson, we'll be parodying the Gene Wilder classic musical Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory as Esther and the Hamantaschen Factory at 10 a.m. next Sunday morning. Good times are ahead. Our guest this morning, Gabor Ghiori, is a senior analyst at a think tank called Policy Solutions in Budapest, Hungary. He'll help us understand the fascinating Jewish community of Hungary with insights for us into some of our own issues of Jewish identity here in America. Meet him when we return in a moment on Too Jewish.
Hi, Doris. How are you?
Well, Carol, to be honest, now that I'm a little older, I can't get out as much as I'd like. I miss seeing people.
Why don't you come over to my place for lunch on us? The food's delicious. So many choices. And I have a special table with my friends every day. They'd love to have you join us.
Is there much to do there?
There are lots of activities every day. Mondays is Mahjong. Tuesdays I do yoga. Wednesdays we go shopping or to the museum or a restaurant. Thursday is my exercise class. There are book groups, speakers, Shabbos services, concerts, a game room. I'm busier than ever.
Where do you live?
I'm at Handmaker. And the people are great. Please come over for lunch. You'll love it. It's even kosher. Just call me at 322-7035.
Handmaker Jewish Services for the Aging offers the full spectrum of quality senior living and post-hospital rehabilitative care. Call 322-7035. Handmaker for life. 322-7035.
Hi, my name is Lariella, and I'd like to tell you how you can help send children like me to a Jewish day school at no cost to you. Arizona allows its taxpayers to receive a tax credit for payments made to recognized school tuition organizations such as JETCO. JETCO is the only tuition organization solely dedicated to Jewish education in Tucson. JETCO provides scholarships to children who attend qualified private schools like Congregation Anshai Israel's Kindergarten and Tucson Hebrew Academy, which educates students from grades K through 8th. You may give up to $1,087 for single tax filers and $2,173 for married couples who file jointly. Jewish education nurtures Jewish identity for generations of students like me, so please go online and visit our website at www.jetco.org or give JETCO a call at 647-8442. Again, that's 647-8442. And tell them Mariella sent you.
We are delighted to welcome the two Jewish our guests this morning. Gabor Ghiori is a senior analyst at a think tank called Policy Solutions in Budapest, Hungary. He's an expert on the political situation in Hungary, but also deeply involved with the Jewish community in that very interesting part of the world. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the invitation.
Tell us, just kind of in an overview, how do Jews in Hungary feel today about their own identity, about their developing experience of Judaism in a complicated country?
I think to some extent, the best way to describe it would be to say that the Jewish community is divided in the sense that many people have very strongly embraced their Jewish identity and are very active in the community. So we have one of the most vibrant Jewish communities in Europe. It is also one of the few remaining Jewish communities with any significant number. We have about, there are an estimated 100,000 Jews in Hungary out of the population of 10 million. And I think that many people, because to a significant extent, the public open Semitism has become more open, and many Jews perceive, I think, correctly the public attitude is to some extent hostile to Jews, though this is not a universally true of Hungarian society, but there has been an increasing trend of anti-Semitism. And because of that, I think that the other part of the Jewish community has reacted by kind of moving away from their Jewish identity and trying to assimilate more fully and to forget about their Jewish roots, because to some, this offers the easiest way to deal with this atmosphere.
It is a complicated atmosphere, both the heritage of the Shoah, the terrible events of the Holocaust, and then 50-some years of communist rule in which religious expression was, if not made illegal, deeply discouraged. Do Hungarian Jews now, as they discover their identity, are some of them discovering positive aspects for the first time?
I think so. Yes, part of it is what you said. Religion was very difficult. It was very difficult to maintain a religious life, and this was true not only of Jews. This was true of pretty much everyone. So if you embraced your if somebody followed a religious lifestyle, it meant that many careers it would be difficult to pursue many careers. It meant you were probably being watched and so on. So I think that what people are discovering is, on the one hand, some people are discovering their religious identity. And at the same time, I think that the fact that you can know much more openly talk about being Jewish, it was something that I think many people had a very keen sense of this identity. And obviously, even if it was not something you would publicly discuss before, but many people clearly had related to some extent, but it was something very private before. Like all religious identity, it was something that was private, and it was not something you could relate to publicly. And I think that many people now have the opportunity to be active in the Jewish community, to talk about these things publicly. And this, I think that it's not only a question of do people relate, they have discovered something positive. I think many people are discovering many facets of their Jewish identity during this time, because there wasn't this opportunity to exchange yourself in public about being Jewish before.
We will talk much more with Gábor Győri about not only the Jewish situation in Hungary, but the political situation when we come back in just a few moments here on Too Jewish. We welcome our friends David and Pamela from Freedom Smoke. Good morning.
Hey, good Rabbi. Morning.
You have a very wide range of ages in your clientele.
Yes, we do. Anywhere from 18 up to 90.
90. So people who are 90 decide they finally want to quit smoking.
Yes. They want to see their grandchildren or their great-grandchildren graduate high school and get married, go to college, that kind of thing.
It's incredible. What's the oldest person you've ever served?
Me personally, I had one that was 90. Last week, I had one that was 88. He's been with us for a couple of years and very, very pleased with how he quit, and his health is getting much better than it used to be.
You can breathe easier. You can smell things. You can taste things that you haven't been able to do so in years.
It's incredible. Where can people go to find out more information?
You can either visit us at our website at freedomsmokeusa.com, or you can call on our 800 number, 800-705-7013.
And we have 4 stores around the greater Tucson area. We're in Catalina, Sierra Vista, and we're even in southern Michigan.
Thanks so much, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Do you know someone who personally made a major difference for the whole Jewish people? An individual who's done important work for Klal Yisrael and deserves to be highly recognized for that effort. As president of the Kohan Memorial Foundation, I'm grateful that the modest cash awards we started more than 10 years ago have grown into a substantial amount of unrestricted funds given to winners, with the help of donors like many of you. The foundation, named for my grandparents, Rabbi Samuel S. Kohan and Irma Kohan, makes these awards for important service to Klal Yisrael, the entire Jewish people. That service can be in one of 4 activities: unity, education, creative arts, or rescue. Past Kohan Award recipients are remarkable people who've done outstanding work. If you know someone who qualifies for a Kohan Foundation Award, go to kohanaward.com, kohanaward.com, and fill out the simple nomination form. That website is kohanaward.com. Nominate an individual or donate yourself. Do it for the whole Jewish people. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or akvel, please email us at tojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's T-O-O, Jewish Radio 18 at Gmail, or visit our website, tojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there, or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store as very valuable Jewish podcasts, top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
As you know, I had a trip to Vienna, Budapest, and Prague, a rabbinic mission trip in January and February. You know those cities extremely well. Vienna, you lived in for a number of years. I was fascinated by the Jewish communities in each, all of them kind of revival Jewish communities after the Holocaust, but very different in character.
They are, in fact, all very different. You're right. I lived in Vienna for almost 5 years. And during those 5 years, for about 6 weeks every year, I lived in Prague because I was responsible for organizing a huge meeting that took place in the foreign ministry And it was theoretically on the level of foreign ministers, although practically there were never more than three or four foreign ministers. Most sent somewhat more junior representatives.
Deputies,
but still,
of some kind.
I spent a long time in Prague every year. So I'm not sure that I would describe really any of those communities as totally a revival community, because each of those communities has families that one way or another survived the Holocaust and that have, quote unquote, always been there. So there's a certain amount of historic continuity in each of those places, and certainly more than in a place like Berlin, for example, where the vast majority of the Jewish community, I mean, over 90%, is either relatively recent arrivals from the former Soviet Union or Israelis who may or may not have had German roots, but who went back after two or three generations in Israel, not after 5 or 10 years. That's not totally the case in any of the three cities that you visited.
You know, Vienna, they talk about how it's the fourth Jewish community of Vienna. There was one in the early Middle Ages or high Middle Ages that was destroyed. A second community that started and lasted until the Turks were almost at the gates. They kicked out the Jews. The Turks came and they brought Jews back in. And then they sort of feel that almost all of the Jews of Vienna, which is central place of Austrian Judaism, rather, were destroyed. Either they emigrated out before the war, or Eichmann got them. The Nazis got them, and in the long period of the Anschluss, and there weren't very many Jews that survived, and so they see it as another community. But there are some Viennese Jews still that go back.
And they have interesting stories. And, you know, among American Jews, I think there's a widespread perception that Austrians were incredibly anti-Semitic, in part because they welcomed Hitler. But the truth, as always, is more complex. I have a friend whose grandparents lived on the same street that I lived on in central Vienna, very near the Stephansdom, the central cathedral. And his grandfather was like an Air Force officer and sort of pro-Nazi and kind of right-wing, whereas his grandmother was a humanitarian, left-wing sort of hippie person who, while the Jews were being marched through the streets on their way to being deported, gave them water and food at the risk of her own life and at the risk of her husband's disapproval. So even within one family, within one married couple, you had both extremes. And certainly in the years after the war, when Vienna was like a cultural desert and Austria lost all of its sparkle and its intellectual and cultural vigor, the Austrians realized that, the Jews played a more important role here than we realized. And so they made a conscious policy to welcome people back who had Austrian roots and who might have left before the Holocaust or who somehow survived. The vice president of the parliament when I was there was the daughter of a Jewish family, and she was sent to hide in Berlin to survive the war. They figured that Berlin was safer than Vienna.
Oh my God.
She did survive the war with a Christian family, and she came back very aware of her Jewish identity and her Jewish roots, and she rose to be vice president of the Austrian parliament.
It's a complicated place.
Yeah.
Thanks, Tom. We'll continue next week.
I look forward to it.
We welcome Oshrat Barel, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Oshrat.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
We started talking last week about the horrific conditions in Syria, that Israel is bringing in about 100 Syrians with citizenship, which means they
kids
can bring in their families. You know, Syria has been the implacable enemy of Israel since 1947, you know, the initial partition agreement before the declaration of the state even. Israelis have fought in wars against Syria at least three, four times. There's been an ongoing border dispute with Syria, and yet Syria has dissolved into this horrible civil war for the last 5 years. How do Israelis think about Syrians who have been their enemies throughout the history of Israel?
It's a very good question. And some of the patient doctors of Ziv Hospital in Tzfat.
So that's in the north. It's the closest to Syria.
It's the closest to the border. And they are treating like refugees, or I don't know if they're refugees because some of them going back to Syria. So the doctors being asked, like, how they treat the people from Syria, and some of the Syrian, which of course their face is not, you can't see the real face.
No, they
kind of
doctor the
shaded
face so you can't see them on
because
TV.
Not to put them in risk, but they also answer the question. And we need to remember, before I will answer you, we need to remember that we, the Israelis in general, never been raised to hate the Syrian. Maybe we are afraid of, maybe, but we no one raises and educates in school to hate the Syrians. I can't say the same about the Syrian. So when they are coming here, they are coming with fear and hate, maybe a little bit hope. But the doctors, they don't afraid because they can do nothing to the doctors. They are in Israel and they don't hate them, you know, like in general. So, and of course, the doctors need to, they have their own oath. So
the
they need to give,
oath,
exactly.
To so
they
everyone.
Need, but as an Israelis, more than as doctors, they said that they treat them at least the same, if not even better, because they feel sorry for them, because they are, you know, they want them to have a better life in the future. So I think that what they give them, it's more than medical treatment. Also, they're trying to give them the support they need. Like, for instance, they said like a daughter came with her mother. Both of them were injured and were hospitalized in different departments, one for kids and one different. And then they saw that the kid like didn't open her mouth, didn't say anything. And, you know, they connected the dots to say, okay, maybe it's not good to take her to the department of the adults, but we will bring the mother next to her to stay in
the hospital.
To hospitalize them in the same department.
Same ward or the same area.
Both correct. Of them need different treatment. So they collaborate and the mother got her treatment, but next to her daughter, and they saw the change immediately with the daughter that felt like all the fear, you know, I'm in an Israeli hospital, what they will do to me, you know. So this is, I think it shows you how the Israelis really not just treating them, but really going out of their skin, I don't know.
Out of their way, yeah.
Bidiuk, in order to really, really help these refugees.
You know, there's a phrase, the Jewish heart, and really that's what shows that there's compassion and assistance, and it's little known, but the truth is many Palestinians, including major figures in Hamas, are treated in Israeli hospitals on a regular basis because the hospitals are better and the care is better, and they're treated at the same high level of care that Israeli Jews get. There's no distinction made.
It was a quick anecdote that the first days of Gaza war back then in 2014, one of the first days of the war, and Mahmoud Abbas' wife was treated in a hospital in Tel Aviv.
Right. The head of Fatah, the head of the Palestinian Authority. Thanks very much, Ashrat. We'll talk next
Thank
week.
Thank you.
If you or a loved one is dealing with a cancer diagnosis, managing the healthcare maze might be one of the hardest things you ever do. We're Advocation Services, private patient advocates serving Tucsonians living with cancer. We focus on helping you while you focus on getting better. Visit us at advocationservices.com or call us at 616-0005.
Is your aging loved one unhappy and having a hard time adjusting to life around them? The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker may be able to help. TMC Geropsych specializes in providing short-term inpatient services for older adults experiencing behavioral health issues. Did you know that most people with depression get better when they seek help? With the right treatment, those with anxiety can overcome and learn to cope with their fears, and individuals with dementia can continue leading quality lives. Our team, led by a geriatric psychiatrist, brings expertise from disciplines across a variety of specialties to ensure your loved one receives the right diagnosis and treatment. For more information about our services, please call 324-4600. The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker. Call 324-4600. Let's talk about how we can help.
We welcome our maven on Jewish education, John Ben Asher, head of the Tucson Hebrew Academy. Boker Tov, John.
Boker Or. Good morning, Rabbi. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning. We were talking last week about school choice and how in the old days, you know, like when we were in school, there were only a couple of choices. That also meant that if you were at a Jewish day school, which you attended, you went to THA.
Right.
You know, it's pretty reliable population. You kind of knew who was going to be in a Jewish day school. It was very Jewishly active families,
right?
Orthodox, conservative, some Reform, maybe. Pretty much that is not exactly your population today, is it?
It's interesting because our population today is very diverse in terms of Jewish identity. We have the whole range of families in practice at the school. We have a few non-Jewish kids too, and we embrace everybody at the school. We're what's called a community day day school, which makes things a little more complicated for us because our program doesn't have a specific angle or branch of Judaism where the focus is. Our focus is on all of Judaism, so it's more of a holistic approach. And yes, we have Orthodox families and conservative families and Reform families, and we have lots of families that aren't affiliated with any of the main branches. We have families who are intermarried. We have families who, you know, the grandparent might have been Jewish. And so there's a whole rainbow, if you will, of different kinds of folks. And it's exciting. It brings a lot of strengths to the school, and it has its challenges too. We can't be everything to everybody, and we really don't try to be. We know who we are and what we're about, and we stick with that. And it provides a broad appeal for families across the Jewish spectrum. And it's just, it's a place where a Jewish kid can be at home. And it's not just okay to be a Jew, but it's celebrated. It's important. It's valued. It's a big deal. So it's great. And we have what I call a big tent, and everybody's welcome.
You know, I'll tell you a funny story. We have a couple of families who have come through Temple Emanuel preschool, not Jewish, mm-hmm. went on to THA. Their kids are at THA. They love the
Isn't
education.
That interesting? Yeah.
You never would have predicted that.
Right. You know, and we're diverse religiously. We're also diverse ethnically. We have, you know, from Anglo to Latino, African American, Asian American, Native American, everybody's at THA. And I love that because it's very Tucson. It really feels like Tucson and represents the community of Tucson very, very well.
Fascinating. And yet they're getting a tremendously positive experience of Judaism.
Absolutely.
And a great education.
Absolutely.
Thanks, John. We'll talk next week.
Thank you, Rabbi.
When we return on To Jewish, we'll get the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie New, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. NASA has sent many spacecraft to orbit the Earth and attempted to include passengers of all races, colors, and creeds. One day, they realized they'd never invited anybody from the clergy, so they invited a priest and a rabbi to orbit the Earth. On their return, the priest and rabbi were asked to go straight to the media room to give the world their impressions of this amazing experience. The priest came into the room with a huge smile on his face. His statement was full of joy. He said, "It was totally amazing. I saw the sun rise and set. I saw the beautiful oceans. I'm in awe of God's creation. What a gift." But the rabbi came into the room completely disheveled. His beard was tangled, his kippah askew, and his tallis a wrinkled mess. The reporters asked him if he'd enjoyed the experience. He threw his hands in the air and said, "Enjoy? Oy vey, you must be joking. How did I find time to enjoy? Every few minutes, the sun goes up and down. It was on with the tefillin, off with the tefillin, on with the tefillin, off with the tefillin." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. Okay, you see, Orthodox Jews and some conservative and Reform Jews put on phylacteries, prayer straps, tefillin for morning services every day. And in a spaceship in orbit, you would have a new day every couple of minutes. You know, on with the tefillin, off with the... If you have to explain a joke... On the subject of tefillin, we have been rediscovering a very fun musical friend of 30 years ago, Rabbi and cantor Seymour Rockoff, who sang like a cantor but was very funny. Here's his version of Tie a Pair of Tefillin.
I wear them almost every day, but not on Shabbos when they're tucked away. Since I was bar mitzvah every morning without fail, I put on what my Zadie brought from Eretz Yisroel. From Eretz Yisroel. Each day I tie a pair of tefillin round my arm and head. After all night long I'm asleep in bed. If I don't tie those tefillin round my arm and head, the day don't begin, I've committed a sin. Mine is Shomer's day. Tie those pair of tefillin round my arm and head.
finest Rebbe that I had. No, no one taught me better than my dad. I can still remember it when he first showed me how. Though it's been so many years, it seems like just right now. It seems like just right now. Cause I still tie a pair of tefillin round my arm and head. After all night long, I'm asleep in bed. If I don't tie those tefillin round my arm and head, the day don't begin, I've committed a sin. My neshama's dead. If I don't tie those pair of tefillin round my arm and head.
That was Rabbi Seymour Rockoff's great parody, Tie a Pair of Tefillin. To be honest, it's better than the original song. A good, silly song in the spirit of the upcoming Festival of Purim next Saturday night and Sunday morning. And now a word of Torah. This week we observe Shabbat Zachor, the Sabbath of Remembrance in Jewish tradition. By custom, after reading our weekly Torah portion of Titzaveh from Exodus, we add a short section of text that recalls the attack of the enemy nation Amalek on our Israelite stragglers when we escaped from Egypt during the Exodus. This attack, vicious and cowardly, is memorialized each year on the Shabbat prior to Purim. The short Maftir section begins and ends with words of memory. Zachor et asher asalacha Amalek. It begins, remember what Amalek did to you. And it concludes with a powerful statement, Timche et zecher Amalek mitachar hashamayim al tishkach. Obliterate the memory of Amalek under heaven. Don't forget. We always read this section the week before Purim, which commemorates the great salvation of the Jews of Iran in Mordechai and Esther's time, about 2,400 years ago, because Haman, the villain of the Purim story, is supposed to be a descendant of the Amalekites. By a variety of other traditions, all deep enemies of Judaism and Jews are linked somehow to Amalek and Haman, including, in some peculiar readings, Torquemada and even Hitler, who actually outlawed Purim in Nazi Germany. By some interpretations, the late unlamented Saddam Hussein, who lost the first Gulf War on Purim of 1991 and saw the second Gulf War that finally toppled him begin on Purim 2003, and Iran's anti-Semitic mullah leader Ayatollah Khomeini are also descendants of Haman and thus the Amalekites. The beat goes on. There are many curious customs associated with this mitzvah, the very specific commandment issued here, to obliterate Amalek. Some Jewish communities on Purim write the name Amalek on their shoes and then rub them off on the floor during the Megillah reading. A traditional sofer, a Torah scribe, begins to write a new Torah by inscribing the name Amalek on a piece of parchment and then blotting it out. Since Haman was an Agagite, descended from the king of the Amalekites, the whole customs of groggers and noisemaking on Purim to blot out Haman's name comes from this same commandment. All of it raises a very good question. Amalek was a minor people, more of a tribe than a nation. As a distinct political entity, it has long disappeared from the earth. In fact, if we really wish to obliterate Amalek's name from under heaven, the easiest way would be for Jews to stop talking about it. Nobody else would ever mention Amalek again. Poof, Amalek is gone, blotted out. And yet, instead, we read this passage twice a year in every synagogue in the world, once in Deuteronomy during the regular Torah reading cycle, and again just before Purim on this coming Shabbat Zachor. Why the elaborate need to remember a truly antique wrong done to us? Psychoanalysts could say that the profound emotional injury perpetrated on our people at the very moment of redemption, we had just gotten out of Egypt after 400 years of slavery, that it was so painful we Jews have never really gotten over it. The catharsis of remembering and overcoming Amalek each and every year helps us move to a healthier, more holistically complete place. We remember so that we will overcome. Political scientists look at this remembering differently. They would suggest that the military and organizational weakness that allowed the straggling that Amalek took advantage of must be remembered so that we can avoid falling into that trap again. Organization, preparation, strength, a proper plan for functioning are all essential to being a real Jewish nation. Moral experts might even see this paradoxical need as a kind of Davka experience. The commandment to exterminate actually forces us to remember our own failings. Thus, we can never become too confident of our prowess or foresight, and must somehow remain humble. But we could also see this more simply. Remembering Amalek, well, remembering in general might be the primary Jewish act. We are commanded, using this exact same Hebrew word, zachor, to remember Shabbat, an unalloyed good, just as Amalek is considered an unadulterated evil. Both are to be remembered. Our existence as intelligent, informed, thoughtful people, as true Jews, is contingent on our ability to really learn to do Torah. In order to do that well, we must exercise our memories vigorously and completely. That is true for both the positive and challenging experiences of our lives. Only by remembering both the good and the bad, and learning from both, can we achieve the highest level of serving B'Tselem Elohim, as imitators of God. The founder of Hasidism, the Baal Shem Tov, said, "Remembering is the secret to redemption. By remembering, we learn. And in doing so, we can learn how to act now and in the future and for the future." When we return on To Jewish, our guest, Gabor Giori, tells us about the fascinating Budapest and Hungarian Jewish community and what's going on in Hungary now and what it can teach us about our own American Judaism. Find out when we come back in a moment here on To Jewish. We welcome John Ben Asher, head of school for Tucson Hebrew Academy. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Rabbi Kohan.
Tell us about THA.
THA is an incredible school, rich community, strong educational culture. We're a K-8 program and Tucson's only Jewish day school.
With small classes, really a tremendous level of individual attention.
Absolutely. Our engaging, talented faculty ensure a rigorous, interactive, supporting learning environment for kids.
And those kids go on to succeed academically. This isn't just about Jewish identity.
THA graduates go on to Tucson's best high schools, and they are exceptionally well prepared.
And I've seen some of them go to Ivy League schools, some of the best colleges in the country too, if that's important for parents, which I believe it is.
That's right. THA really paves the way for students. A rich, strong academic foundation, as well as Jewish knowledge, learning, and culture.
And great community. How can people find out more about putting their kids in THA?
You can come visit or find us online, thaaz.org, and give us a call, 529-3888.
That's 529-3888, or visit www.thaaz.org.
If you or a loved one is dealing with a cancer diagnosis, managing the healthcare maze might be one of the hardest things you ever do. We're Advocation Services, private patient advocates, serving Tucsonans living with cancer. We focus on helping you while you focus on getting better. Visit us at advocationservices.com or call us at 616-0005.
We continue with our To Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
A wave of electronically generated bomb threats were phoned into JCC's Jewish community centers all across the country, including ours here in Tucson, Arizona. This is the fifth time since January 1st that such threats have been received, and the response to such a threat requires locking down and sometimes evacuating the JCC's. The bomb threats at the JCC's have all proven to be false alarms. To date, there have been no bomb threats made against synagogues. As reported previously on To Jewish, the bomb threats are camouflaged electronically to make it seem as though the calls are coming from inside the building threatened. The FBI continues to search for the perpetrators. In Philadelphia, a Jewish cemetery was attacked just a week after a similar incident was reported at a Jewish burial ground in suburban St. Louis. 100 headstones or so at Mount Carmel's cemetery were discovered knocked over last Sunday. Several of them were broken. Police are investigating. The vandalism at Mount Carmel comes after a similar attack at Chesed Shel Emet Cemetery in University City, Missouri. As many as 200 headstones were toppled there. That incident, along with the bomb threats, has sparked anxiety among many U.S. Jews. At the beginning of his address to the Joint Houses of Congress last week, President Donald Trump took a strong stand against anti-Semitism and acts of racist violence. He did so at the very beginning of his speech. He said, "Recent threats targeting Jewish community centers and vandalism of Jewish cemeteries, as well as last week's shooting in Kansas City," that was of two Indian men, "remind us that while we may be a nation divided on policies, we are a country that stands united in condemning hate and evil in all its forms." Well, we here on Too Jewish applaud the president making this strong statement at the commencement of such a prominent speech. We have waited for this approach since the first bomb threats to JCCs began in January, and we certainly welcome it now. We hope it presages a turn against hate speech and the vilification of minorities, and a return to standards of civility and decency at the highest levels of government and throughout American society as a whole. In other and somewhat contradictory news, the Trump administration's proposals to cut billions of dollars in domestic spending in favor of shifting an additional $54 billion to the military in the new budget included closing the federal office to monitor and combat anti-Semitism. Trump reportedly is considering cutting a number of special envoy positions, including one dedicated to fighting anti-Semitism, as part of a forthcoming budget proposal. He will propose making cuts in federal agencies to accommodate the 10% defense increase in the new budget. Trump wants to kill some special envoy positions, including not only the one dealing with anti-Semitism, but also those dealing with climate change and Muslim communities. Congress mandated the position of a special envoy for monitoring and combating anti-Semitism back in 2004 when it passed the Global Anti-Semitism Review Act. We hope the president reconsiders removing this position, especially at this time of rising public acts of anti-Semitism. And that's the Too Jewish News of Jews Around the World. We welcome back to Too Jewish our guest this morning. Gabor Giori is a senior analyst at a think tank called Policy Solutions in Budapest, Hungary, an expert on the Hungarian political, the complexities of the Hungarian political situation, as well as on the Jewish community in Budapest and all of Hungary. You know, we tend to think of the fall of the Iron Curtain and the increased freedoms that came to countries like Hungary and the Czech Republic as being very important. But each of those countries has gone through a very different process. Can you tell us a little bit about Hungary, how Hungary developed? I was there 20 years ago and then just recently. Tell us sort of how, can you give us an overview on all of that?
I think very briefly, Hungary came out of, during the regime transition phase, Hungary was doing better probably than most other countries. They had a very peaceful transition. The Communist Party gave up power. There was no bloodshed. There was no major violence. And it seemed initially that Hungary was picking up, was adjusting to this new environment very well. They had an extremely stable political system as compared to the other countries of the region. The economy was doing also well. But I think that this also led people to underestimate, to imagine that this would be a very unilinear process, that there could be no backsliding from the progress that Hungary was making. And we discovered there was a major economic shock even before the global financial crisis. We had a major economic problem. The state was having trouble managing the economy, and then the international financial crisis came, which hit Hungary because of this vulnerability a lot worse than many other countries, and it also destroyed this we had this bipolar political system in Hungary with two major forces that were kind of balancing each other, and this balance was destroyed in the process. We have a right-wing government now that is not even the important part, but it's ideological leaning, but it's a very authoritarian party. And because this party won a constitutional majority in the 2010 elections, it's fairly easy in Hungary to change the constitution if you have a majority in parliament. And it has rewritten the political ground rules in Hungary. And there has been a major shift authoritarian shift in Hungary. And there is not much conversation all over the world. We are seeing this kind of authoritarian shift. But Hungary was one of the first countries to go in this direction. And so we have had a major regression in terms of the development of democracy. And this has also gone hand in hand with the regression in the market, in the way the market works, because the state in Hungary is leaning very strongly on the market. It's very active in shaping market configurations and in trying to favor certain players over other players. So it is, we are in Hungary is kind of backtracking from the Western model, and we don't know yet where we will end up.
Viktor Orlov has been a complicated figure, and he now dominates Hungarian politics. Can you explain his rise a little bit to those of us who didn't know much about Hungary before?
Yes, he was a very talented young politician. He still is probably the most talented politician in Hungary, and he became known primarily as this young opposition figure to the communists. He rose to being one of the major, most recognizable opposition figures. But at that time, his ideology, at the time of regime transition in 1990, his ideology was what you would best describe this as a social liberal person and economically conservative person. This is what you would call a classical liberal. And there was no major political market for this kind of ideology. I think that the majority of Hungarian society is probably pretty conservative on social issues and tends to be on the left when it comes to economic issues. Most Hungarians believe that the government should play a major role in the economy. So this was the direct opposite of what Viktor Orban initially held. So there was a very strong right wing. He perceived that his best, the best way to become politically influential in Hungary was on the right wing of the political spectrum, because there was kind of a big vacuum there. There weren't major players. So he repositioned himself as this nationalist and very conservative political leader. This took a decade or so, and the process really has maybe even two decades until this process was complete. But he shifted over time, and he became, thanks to the shift, he became, and to his political talent, he's a very good speaker, and he recognizes the public mood better than anybody in Hungarian politics. So he has emerged as the most successful leader on the political right initially, and then he managed to establish a very strongly hegemonic position for his party in Hungarian politics. And part of that is, and this is of particular relevance to the Jewish community, is that part of the way he appeals to the broader public is he's trying to go back to this era when he says that he's trying to put a positive spin on the eras of Hungarian history, which he perceives as the glory time of Hungary. And this is, in his perception, is the 1920s and 1930s, which for obvious reasons were difficult times for Jews in Hungary, in particular because Hungary was one of the first countries to have Jewish laws. There was a Jewish law even before the Nazis came into power in Germany, and then Hungary was one of the most faithful allies of Germany, implementing the Jewish laws one after the other, and then in the end, after some initial hesitation, also facilitating the deportation of Hungarian Jewry. So Hungarians, for obvious reasons, relate very critically to the political elite at the time of during the interwar period, while Orban is kind of glorifying this period, because at that point he perceives the values, the strong nationalist values of the time, and expansionist policies of the government at the time are for him a glory period of Hungary. So, and he's elevating several politicians, very controversial politicians, some of whom were known for their very public anti-Semitism and as driving forces behind the anti-Jewish laws. He's trying to elevate these figures as well into kind of on the pantheon of Hungarian politics.
One of the really fascinating aspects of visiting Budapest was hearing about I don't know, 18 different synagogues, 40 Jewish institutions that have developed for a community that has 100,000 Jews, but perhaps only 5,000 to 10,000 that are actively doing Jewish stuff on a regular basis. What do you see in the future for the Hungarian Jewish community, most of which is, almost all of which is in Budapest now?
Yes, part of it is because the deportations were fairly successful in the countryside, so the surviving community remained in Budapest, and the few Jews who survived in the countryside also tended to move to Budapest. It is hard to tell. I think that to some extent, demography works against Jewish life in Hungary. It also works against, I have to add, that religious life in general. As far as I can tell, all religious denominations are struggling with the fact that young people do not tend to be observant. But I think it's because the Jewish community, because of its small size, is more sensitive to the fact that young people tend to be less religious. This is one aspect of it. So this is definitely a major challenge for the Jewish community. On the other hand, I see that a lot of young people are active, a lot of young people are interested in discovering the Jewish root. There has been a very successful summer camp in Hungary for Jewish youth that has built a kind of a generation of young people who are involved in the community. I think that the way for the Jewish community to work over the long time is, I don't think that the Jewish community has a chance to survive unless it manages to integrate secular and religious Jews if it manages to build a community that involves both secular and religious Jews in Hungary, because I think just the number of religious people will be too small to maintain a community.
I say everybody has to kind of get along because of the size of the community.
Yes, it's too small, I think. This is a challenge for all religions, but it is obviously a bigger challenge for a community that is so small to begin with. I see that on really much of the community life is very open, in the sense that most of the Jewish events in Hungary and in the Jewish community in Hungary are not religious events. They are events that either combine religion, but make it very open and accessible to secular Jews, or they are secular events in the first place, which I think is the best way to keep the community together.
I want to thank Gabor Giori for a great visit here on Two Jewish. Where can people go to find out more online about the Hungarian Jewish community and about Hungary in general?
There are several websites there on Facebook, but I'm not sure if they are in English, because I never needed to check in English, to be honest. But there is a great Jewish community house in Budapest, which is called Balint, B-A-L-I-N-T, Haz, H-A-Z, which is the major community center in Budapest. And I'm sure and I hope that on the Facebook page they have an English language.
They do.
They also have a website.
There's always Google Translate. They'll come up with something vaguely close to something understandable. Thank you so much for a great visit. And when we come back on Two Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical play out.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here on Two Jewish this morning with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday. It'll be Purim. Our guest will be Abigail Pogrebin, author of the brand new book, My Jewish Year, 18 Holidays, One Wandering Jew. And of course, listen to all of our Top 10 in America podcasts on iTunes or stream them at our TOOJewishRadio.com website, TooJewishRadio.com. Our playout this morning on Two Jewish comes from Eitan Freilich, his upbeat rendition of Am Yisrael Chai, The People Israel Lives, in preparation for Purim, Saturday night and Sunday. Don't miss the greatest Purim show in the world at Temple Emmanuel, 10 a.m. next week, just after Two Jewish, and our version of Esther and the Hamantaschen Factory, a parody of Willy Wonka in tribute to the late Gene Wilder. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, a week we pray of peace, and a Chag Purim Sameach.
לפעמים קשה, צריך נחמה, מתפשט הפחד, ממלא את הנשמה. לא קל להתמודד, ונראה שאין מוצא, מחפש כתף לתמיכה. פתאום אשב תקווה, יש בי עוצמה של
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.